What would you say are some of the practical, legal, and ethical framework challenges developed due to technological innovation, such as unmanned aerial systems, drones, and data collection programs?
So I guess I'll try and do this by each individual category. So practically speaking, unmanned aerial vehicles offer a really great window into places where we previously didn't have access. But at the same time, they offer significant challenges in terms of legality and ethics. The UAV systems have garnered a lot of criticism, largely because they act as a sort of judge, jury, and executioner, you can almost say. They don't give us the full picture, and they'll never be able to give us the full picture. There are countless examples of collateral damage, of target strikes that struck the wrong person. That's a huge, huge issue for the program. It's something that's been highly, highly criticized in the international community. The United States has a prolific drone program that works in conjunction with its intelligence services to commit these surgical strikes. And it's something that's going to be interesting, again, to see what happens in the future. How will laws and legal frameworks begin to address this challenge that is still relatively new, but hasn't so far gone ahead and tried to tackle that issue kind of wholeheartedly. And in terms of mass data collection, I think this is something that's one of the big issues of our time right now. Privacy and what information are these large corporations, but also the intelligence community, collecting from us online. Pretty much everyone has, or everyone at least in the, you know, the Western world has an online presence. We have a cell phone, we have Facebook, we have a computer, we have email. And the ability for these types of programs to take all of that information and do whatever they want with it is a huge, huge issue for a lot of people. And at this point, there's been little evidence to support that it's prevented anything from happening. So there are, again, a lot of criticism in the international community about these types of mass data collection programs. And they're indiscriminate data collection. The US, Germany all have laws about spying on their own citizens, and how international intelligence cooperation through these types of programs circumvents these kinds of laws. So that's a huge issue as well.
You also attended a conference at the Mackenzie Institute. This conference focused on cybersecurity, terrorism, and also EMP, electromagnetic pulse attack. I wanted to ask you a question pertaining to one of Dr. Christopher A. Parsons' arguments. He argued that by having information stored in an electronic database, having everyone's medical reports and information in one database, it's difficult to prevent the possibility of a cyber attack. And once that cyber attack would take place, millions of medical files and records would become public. What is your opinion in terms of health records being stored electronically in a database? Should that be changed? What policies should perhaps be implemented in order to better protect the privacy, specifically medical privacy, from being leaked or from being exposed as a result of a cyber attack?
In terms of cyber attacks and access to information, the difficult thing about cyber attacks is that we're really uncertain about what people can actually do. Even someone with very rudimentary computer skills can do a lot of damage. But at the same time, we exist in a world today where things like, you know, storing information in a cloud or storing medical records online or on a computer is almost a necessity. We couldn't go back to paper records anymore. That just
I understand.
wouldn't work. So it's a give and take. It's a matter of recognizing that there are these threats there, and that they are very, very real, that they are very likely able to penetrate systems and take information. And that's going to be something that no matter what we do, it will always happen. But balancing that with the necessity of protecting that information to the best of our ability. Will we always be able to stop everything from happening? No. And I think that's one of the things that the intelligence community has sort of gotten a bad rap for over the last especially over the last 15 years, is that we have this sort of built-up mentality that they're completely infallible and that they should never get anything wrong. But that's just not the case. There are too many things going on in too many places at too many times to prevent everything from happening. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't take the best possible course of action in order to prevent something bad from happening. So when it comes to something like health records, it's the same thing. We need to take every step possible to protect those records and protect information from being stolen, while also understanding that at some point it probably will happen, and then we need to reinforce and mitigate the damage.
Do you think there should be the option that if someone doesn't want their medical information to be accessible via online in a secure database, if they choose not to want to be have their medical records stored that way, should they have the option of opting out?
That's a really tough question. I mean, the way I would sort of look at it is there's two things to it. And so there's the, I mean, I think it would be beneficial to some people that they would prefer not to have it online. And I can definitely appreciate that. But a government needs to work under a certain level of efficiency. And they need to be able to, for example, maintain records for patients.
Ian, some of the significant challenges associated with the modern understanding of intelligence consists of the fact that there is a lack of balance between the human side of intelligence and the technological side of intelligence. And that's something that you've already addressed prior to this. Therefore, human analysis has been replaced by various mechanisms. What are some of the concerns pertaining to replacing human analysis with these mechanisms? And what would you say would be an effective way of addressing these concerns?
So some of the major issues with sort of introducing a computer, so to speak, to do the job of an analyst is that you lose a lot of that human element. People inherently are irrational. They don't act logically like a computer thinks. And so for a terrorist organization, for example, that you're trying to stop from committing an attack, you would lose out on certain connections that a computer may not be able to pick up through email, or certain patterns are developed through human analysis. And so a lot of what happens is you miss connections that you would that an analyst might make. And so I think sort of the best way to mitigate this is to reintroduce more analysts into the system, to put more people back in the process, and to rethink the way that we look at information that we can turn into intelligence. Right now we kind of collect, or intelligence communities collect indiscriminately. They get whatever they can from whoever they can. And the issue with that is you end up in a place where you have too much information and you can't find the important details. It's the sort of proverbial needle in a haystack situation. And by rethinking what information we collect and by introducing more human analysts into the system again, I think is probably the two best ways in order to really combat the challenges that have come along through these sort of algorithmic processes that have been introduced by technological innovation.
Information overload is another challenge associated with the modern understanding of intelligence. What policies and methods would you say should be implemented in order to address these concerns?
So this is sort of one whole chapter of my dissertation.
Pretty much.
Information overload is arguably one of the most difficult challenges that exists in the intelligence community today. And it's not a simple fix. It's a foundational issue. It's a fundamental a challenge. And the best way to sort of start to introduce fixes or changes in terms of policy is by rethinking, again, the way that we think about information and intelligence. Historically, they were often used interchangeably, or one as being the product of the analysis of the other. So information is analyzed, and then it becomes intelligence. And while that's still true and still should be true today, we need to rethink about what information is. In the past, information was whatever you could get your hands on, because there was only so much accessibility and there was only so much information you could actually acquire. Today, we have more information than we could ever know what to do with, terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of information that will never even be analyzed by an analyst, or maybe never even hit on an algorithmic check, even though it's vitally important to an intelligent situation. So in terms of policies and methods, I really think it goes back to rethinking about the way we look at information and what we collect in order to turn it into intelligence. And I think that's the best policy. Technology has changed in the intelligence community, but the foundational elements of the intelligence community have not changed to adapt to it. And so the best policy is to reevaluate the way we look at the theory of intelligence. What is information? What is intelligence? How do we acquire it? And how do we process it? Needs to be reevaluated to better reflect the technology of the time.
In your conclusion, you mentioned that the CIA prides itself by its motto, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." In addition, you state that in a modern context, the truth is there are many benefits to technological innovation. Most assuredly, the intelligence community all over the world has enjoyed these benefits. However, there are significant and debilitating challenges that arise that have only begun to be explored. Taking all of these factors into account, where do you see the future of the CIA 5 years from now?
So I don't claim to be a CIA expert, but what I can say is that the intelligence community as a whole will most definitely, in the next 5 years, continue on the trend that it's on. Technology has, for the last 100 years, played a vital role in the way the intelligence community acts and the way that it goes about its job, which is, you know, security. And I think that 5 years from now, we won't see a change in that. What might change is the technologies that are used. And this is something that you can never really predict, because you won't know until it happens. And oftentimes you won't know when it happens, you'll know 5 years later. It's something that we saw with the Snowden revelations. We didn't really know what the intelligence community was capable of and what technologies they were using until suddenly the world knew. And so I think technology will always have a role to play in the intelligence community. And in the next 5 years, I don't think that's going to change. If anything, you might see changes in how the legalities of certain technologies that are used now. But we'll still be trying to tackle the next big thing before it happens, and probably still playing catch up when it happens. So I think 5 years from now, what we'll see is that technology plays an even bigger role in the intelligence community, and I think that's not necessarily bad, but it's not necessarily good either. Like I mentioned before, I feel like we're losing this sort of human element of intelligence, which makes it really strong. People understand people better than machines and computers understand people, and there can be significant challenges that arise from that. So 5 years from now, we will see.
Yeah, we'll see. What is the best advice you'd be able to provide to the students interested in perhaps pursuing a career in cybersecurity?
I think one of the common trends that I hear when discussing cybersecurity and anything to do with sort of this emerging field is that there's a lot of people that can do one or the other. And when I say that, I mean there's a lot of people that know the technical skills, you know, the technical ins and outs of cyberspace and the internet and all those kinds of things. And on the other end, there's lots that know the sort of international politics sides, the policy and those elements. There are very few people who can do both. And that is a vitally important element, to have someone who can bridge the gap. And I know you spoke to Dr. Parsons about this, and he's one of the rare few who has, you know, a skill set that allows him to do both. So if I was to give advice to someone who wanted to become involved in that sort of community, I would say do something that allows you to do both. Whether that's a joint degree in computer science and political science, or a degree in one or the other with a minor, or taking extra courses at night in order to, you know, learn the extra skills that you need, then do that. Because once you do, you'll be highly, highly desirable in the field, and you won't have any issues finding a whole multitude of places that want to hire you.
Ian, thank you so much for your time today. I greatly appreciate you sitting down to do this interview with me.
Thank you for having me, and I hope everybody enjoys.
Thank you.